We'll start 0 to 1. I'm here to answer questions. I have a great spectrum of wisdom and dummy tax that I paid. You have a question?
Well, beautiful. My name is Billy Carson. I'm the founder of Forbidden Knowledge. And I've done 4 rounds of a Reg CF through my reach online, about 15.5 million. Got about 6,000 investors in my Reg CF. Now I've closed out the last Reg CF, and I just launched a tech fund just a couple of days ago, and I'll fund a PPM. And what I'm looking for is potentially maybe even what you were just talking about a minute ago, a way to connect, link up with one of the main reasons I'm here, find more people that could be interested in this AI-driven tech fund and raising capital.
So we have a show together. It's the number one show on Cheddar. It's a Reg CF show. And so we've used NetCap, DealMaker, a variety of different areas, Start England, obviously, but we actually have been very successful in the other side of it. It'd be interesting, I think, for you to have a conversation with Rory about that fund. And then also Adam getting you to the people. So, yeah. All right. And with that kind of following, we'd love to have you as a titan on the show.
Okay. I'm Justin Carson.
My question for you is, how old were you when you got your first, like, big breakthroughs?
Financial breakthrough or, yeah. So I was going to say my real breakthrough was at 38 years old. I call it my quantum shift. So that was my breakthrough in life of changing the way I looked at things. And it cost me about $100 million for that breakthrough to figure things out. But my financial breakthrough occurred when I graduated law school 9 months afterwards. I made a decision to appreciate what my mom's advice was, but not to follow it. I was an oil and gas litigator out of law school, got a job with an oil company in 1992, far before you were born, for $150,000 a year plus bonus, which was a lot of money in 1992 to come out of law school and make. But I also got offered a commission job selling Westlaw, legal research online. And the internet was DOS, 9600 baud modems, monochrome screens, slow as all shit. There wasn't natural language at the time. It was called Boolean language. So you put /S, fall, quote unquote, grocery store, pick the database, California Reporter, and then it would bring up all the case law. In reverse chronological order, you would use WordPerfect 5.1 to cut and paste because it would highlight where the slip and fall in the grocery store was. You put that into WordPerfect and you'd start to create a memo, and it took a long time. In fact, when I demoed it to the Supreme Court of the United States, Justice Scalia looked at me and said, "Nobody will ever do research on a computer. We need books." And he was serious. So for me, my biggest breakthrough was to believe in, take inventory in my capability. I knew that I wasn't a great lawyer yet, but I knew I was a great salesperson. And I knew I could explain this. I couldn't explain it to Justice Scalia, but I knew I could explain it to lawyers like Rory, that how the economics work of it, so that I could say, look, you're spending this on books in your New York library. It's costing you $120,000 a month for lease space on these books. You can have this computer down there, do it faster, easier, et cetera. And it will cost you $10,000 a month. You'll save $110,000 a month just on the storage fee, right? The lease of space, let alone all the other services that are involved. Can you see any reason you won't want to move forward? And then they were doing the math and going, how about we just get rid of $10,000 worth of space, keep our books, and try this out? And so I made my first $1 million 9 months out of law school. We exited in 95 to Thomson Reuters for $3.4 billion. I then didn't put my ego in the way to be a real lawyer, went to Silicon Valley, learned how to raise money for middleware. So EveryPath, Breon, 724, I raised $169 million in my 20s, learned from Sequoia, Texas Pacific, Amerindo, how to raise money, basically how to take my sales skill and apply it to raising money. Same thing that I took the job for, how to sell things. So I could tell that story. Back then, people like HP Ventures and TPG, they would stroke you after you presented a $10 million check. And back then, they actually had checks. You may not even know what that is. It's a paper. See? Yeah. I'm so old that I was excited when they came out with the ATM. I'm like, you mean I don't have to sit in line on Fridays for an hour at the bank? I can deposit my check in a wall? This is super cool. So you can imagine how freaked out I am when I went into a Waymo and I'm in a car with nobody driving it. Or he drives me home in his Cybertruck, or kind of drives me home. We're talking the whole time. I'm like, wait a second. He's not even looking at the road. So my breakthrough, But breakthroughs occur when you take inventory of your capability. There are no titles. There's no emotional connection to an outcome. When I was your age, I made the mistake of saying, I'll be happy when. Be happy when I graduate. I'll be happy when I make my million. I'll be happy when I make 10 million. I'll be happy when I get married. I'll be happy when I... That shit doesn't work. For me, when I took inventory of my capabilities and said, where do I need to improve? What's doing well? What's stable? What do I think is doing well? How do my capabilities align with those three things? And then develop and ask for help from people who had those skills, that knowledge, and increase my desire every day to be what I must be. Which, by the way, if you want to know how I hire people like Nick, for example, and what I see as a common denominator of, and I've been blessed, billionaires, millionaires, entrepreneurs, celebrities, athletes, and entertainers at the world-class level, from Little John to Troy Aikman to Vander Holyfield to Mark Wahlberg to all Cameron Diaz, all the people that I've been around in my life, they all have one thing in common, the desire that they must be what they can be. That's the only thing they have in common. They know different things. They're good at different things. They all look different. Some have different faults or whatever, but they, every single one down to the T, like this kid Mendoza from IU, I promise you that when I get to talk to him, that I will pick out immediately, this kid has a desire that he must be what he can be. When they told him he's two stars and he couldn't play at Miami, there's no way he doesn't get to where he is unless he had that desire when everybody else basically was saying, dude, you're not good enough. The whole world was telling him, you're not good enough, you're not good enough, you're not good enough. But he had the desire to be what he must be, and he proved what he can be. And he'll be the highest paid player next year in the draft. So did that help you a little bit?
Yes, sir.
Cool. Thank you for coming, you guys.
Hey, guys. Sean by East Personal Branding and Leadership Development. You know my story, Dave.
I love your story.
We've come a long way. We have product to market fit. So we do personal branding and leadership development marketing for clients. It happens in 120 days, super fast. As we scale from multiple 8 to 9 and hopefully 10 figures, that's the goal of a $1 billion brand. Having been there before, what's the fastest route and what needs to be discarded and not even gone through or experienced? How can I fast forward that process without falling victim to the things that you've already fallen victim to?
Yeah.
As we hire and as we scale, I see a lot of misfit and we were constantly kicking people off the bus. So what am I not looking for that I don't even know to look for?
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, people scale and we've moved from working for companies to working for cultures. And so in order to scale to a $1 billion company, you have to build a culture, because culture is sustainable, companies are not. In a matter of minutes, your business, your company has to change. You don't even know what competitors are out there. You don't even know what challenges exist, and they could be 12 to 24 hours away. This is how unstable it is, where in the past to build a brand, right? We could build a brand and have a repetition of communication, know the competitive atmosphere, understand the technology that exists today that won't change for another 5 years dramatically. Now it could be 5 minutes. And so I believe in order to scale a business, you have to scale your culture. And that's why I believe teaching values, teaching daily practices where it's a behavior machine, so they can adjust, and then an execution model that is simple, that people can adapt to the circumstances each and every day, aligned with the company's objectives, which need to be articulated strictly by the incentives that you give your employees. And you need to remind them every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, there's a reason I am giving you this bonus for this, because this is what's prioritized. I know you may think that you have to prioritize this. This is more commission, but this is the incentives. And I know it doesn't make sense to you, but I'm going to pay you extra for it to make sense for you. This is activity you get paid for. You could tell me I'm family. You could tell me you love me, you look up to me, and you dreamed of working with me. But in the end, I know one thing about employees, they want to get paid. And if somebody's willing to pay them more, that love for you and that respect for you and all those things they promise you is bullshit most of the time, 99% of the time, notating that 99% statistics are all made up. Please. This is Roy Kataya, one of my best friends, business partner, CEO of TonX. They went through a $525 million exit, his third exit, CEO of a public company. extremely educated, but more importantly, very abundant and kind, which is why he's my best friend. And younger than me. But...
Not really. What I've learned is that the lessons come between the successes. So I don't know that you necessarily want to try and short circuit the process and try to avoid what you really are not able to predict. Just stay focused on your mission, stay focused on your business, and what comes along, you'll deal with as it comes. Don't try to plan to how to deal with something that may not even arise and be something that you're not expecting. And again, those lessons from the things that are challenging and sometimes result in failures, that will make your successes out. So just remember that.
So lessons come
between the successes.
That's so smart. And I will tell you this personally, being an advisor to his company, months before the $525 million exit, Rory wasn't attached to an outcome going, oh, we're exiting. Don't worry, Dave. This is the plan. It was continue to do what we're doing. Let's evaluate the options and opportunities we have in the for shareholder value. And out of nowhere, 4th of July, we're literally having a conversation. I'm like, what the? And by August, the deal was done. So, you know, he didn't speed that up, but it happened much faster because he didn't try to speed it up. Remember, force creates counterforce. Power doesn't move. Power doesn't move. Force moves and it creates a counterforce. Power doesn't move. And Dr. Pascal will explain that in the universal sense of life force, but it doesn't move. And if you want to read like Dr. David Hawkins, Power versus Force, great thing to change your life about what Rory just explained to us. Right.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Dana, also known as Dana B, your holistic connector.
Nice.
My husband and I launched a podcast also called the DNA Community Podcast in October of last year. And the conduit for me to find you, David, as you know, I met you at Aspire last week, was Claude Silver.
Who I love.
Her role at VaynerMedia has been inspiring to me for many years. I've been consuming Gary Vee's content, I don't even know, 10, 15 years now. I feel like he's a brother from another mother. I was able to meet him before COVID. And long story short, I had a vision of wanting to work with him. And I think I had a dream, or maybe he said it to me. He's like, don't work for me, do your own thing. And I'm doing my own thing. And the only thing is now, besides my spam issue of being able to connect with my community, is building capital and things like that. So I don't have to worry about the bills and things like that that come in. My husband is a huge support of me right now. He's literally in the lobby working himself for his day job. And for me, it's everything that you're saying is in my body. I feel it. I have big, hairy, audacious goals. When you look at my LinkedIn, you'll see that I've been many places for like 2 years and I've grown within those companies. But then I get to the point where it doesn't feel aligned anymore. And either they tell me to exit or I exit, which is why I was impromptu to just start my own thing while I was working at a nonprofit. So my question for you, other than thank you for introducing me to Adam, I look forward to talking to him after this, is, I don't know, I don't have a discouragement. I really have a huge alignment for what my goals are and what I can do, because it's not small. I really want to impact humanity. I want to share my own story and I want to change it for the better, which is why I'm so leaning into what you are doing, because I grew up in California in the 80s and now I'm here in Florida. And I'm loving the wellness community, but I see it so siloed. And I see the need for a chief heart officer for the wellness industry.
Nice.
So that's,
yeah. So there's a real simple thing that happens to a lot of people that have big, audacious goals, is that things happen very slowly, then all of a sudden. And in the context of pursuit in progress, what happens is if we look to results each day, those results are the evidence of results are either non-existent or contrary to where you want to be at all times. And it's just a matter of math. So behavior is aggregate, accelerate, and compound. Money is an energy. So money is the easiest example of energy that will aggregate and accelerate and compound. So, you know, I love taking the example, the government allows us now to put $7,500 to our children. If you put $7,500 a year on a kid that's born today, it'll be $48 million tax-free when they're 65. Do you know what kind of business you need to build to leave your kid $48 million when they're 65 tax-free? That's a big venture. Or you could put $7,500 a year in an account for them and guarantee yourself that with the rate of return. Same thing happens with all other types of behaviors. Different interest rates, different speeds of acceleration, aggregation, and compounding of outcomes. But I promise you that if you change your perspective from attaching to this big, audacious goal, I'm never going to get there because there's no evidence or the evidence is contrary, I'm going to get there, into my behaviors are aligned with getting there today, according to the circumstances of the day, or these behaviors are not aligned and I'm going to dissipate, dissolve, and make them disappear so that I have more time to have more behaviors that are aligned with where I want to get to do. And if I continue to do the right behaviors, I'm going to end up somewhere better than I want to be, but in alignment with this divine direction. So I used to talk about consistent, persistent pursuit of your potential. Be consistent and persistent. Pay attention to what you want and give intention to it. Do, say, think, feel, and believe every single day in alignment with your divine direction. Align your meaning of the past with the divine direction, and those coincidences occur. And somebody asked me about discipline. Well, you're the most disciplined person that I know. I said, you know, I coach a lot of people, and discipline's a two-sided sword. I know so many people that are so disciplined in doing things, but they forget for the sake of what they're doing it. Let me give you a good one that I see entrepreneurs. They're so busy working, they forget to make money. They're literally so busy developing their website and doing this and the domains and this, and they're so busy, they forget to make money. Well, when you opened your LLC, it gave you a first choice of for the sake of what am I doing. It says the very first box, for profit or not for profit? This is the first question they ask you before you put your name on it, before you decide what the entity name it says. And all of you check this box. And then you get so busy working and say, well, I want to change the world. I need to holistic. I need to be the chief heart officer of Florida and blah, blah. No, you're not going to be the chief officer of anything unless you make money and follow what you said you're building this business for the sake of making money so I can spend that money for the sake of being the chief officer of the United States or whatever you want to be. That's why some people resisted. My kids' high school, this one just blew my mind. I was the title sponsor of the football team, even though at that time I only had cheerleaders. And it cost me a lot of money. I've got my name up there, Sports One Marketing, make a lot of money, help a lot of people, and have a lot of fun on the bottom of the scoreboard. Warren Moon and David Meltzer, I'm like, this is what we believe in, man, helping our local community, my kids' school. And the school's like, we can't do that. We can't take my money. No, no, we like to take your money, but is it okay if we put help a lot of people, have a lot of fun, and make a little money? And I'm going to go, that's why you don't have any money, you moron. It's not okay with me. And it's not okay when people tell me that at all. Because I'm in business. It's an activity that I get paid for. Now, what I do with my money is gracious, merciful, and frugal. Because I don't want to waste money. When I'm with my wife, it's not wasting that when I stay at the Waldorf or the Positano San Pietro. Because I'm spending that money for the sake of making her happy, which is well worth it to me. Too many entrepreneurs want balance in their life. Too many young people want balance in their life. There is no balance in the single day. There should be a balance over your lifetime that you spend 25% of your time on your personal life, 25% experientially, 25% giving away, and 25% receiving when you're done. But there's a whole bunch of days in between that you're in harmony by spending the majority of your time according to the circumstances of the day, developing your skills or not. So maybe you're in school. Maybe you have a startup and you have to go ahead and harmonize the time that you spend with the activity you get paid for versus the vacation time and time that you spend with your family. The one thing I've learned about harmony and time is that just because you can't spend time, a lot of it with the things that are most important, you have to have non-negotiable minimums amount of time 7 days a week. I vacation every day, right? I used to have a 55 Ford Thunderbird that sat there so I could grab my wife and just say, hey, we're driving down the Ritz-Carlton, going to the deck for 2 hours because we're vacationing for 2 hours. Now I'm buying a vintage Bronco so we could do the same thing so we could go farther without worrying about breaking down. And I could race Rory in his. So, but honestly, too many people are looking for this balance. Just harmonize your day. I spend a minimum of 7 hours on my sleep, minimum of an hour on my health, minimum of an hour with my family, minimum amount of time on my faith, minimum amount of time on my finance, minimum amount of time studying time so I'm better at it, and most importantly, a minimum amount of time studying relativity of my time. So I'm doing a double check on the meaning for the sake of what am I doing this. I'm double checking it to make sure I don't get so busy doing something to, you know, I talk about having a God-sized hole and filling with everything but God. Entrepreneurs are great at that. You know, people who have addictions are great at that. They have a God-sized hole and then they stop the one addiction and they start filling their God-sized hole with everything but God. And God is your God, your truth, your potential. Does not have to be affiliated with anything involving me. Thank you, though, for your thank you. All right, next question.
Hi. So my name is Afam Saliku, founder and director of Getty Society and Property, co-founder Liam Duffy Madness. I'm over there. And my question is in regards to relationships. So how important is it to find the right partner, right friendships, right relationships when it's about get to your level?
Every level. So I have three buckets, criteria of evaluating my relationships. One is the relativity of that relationship. So my younger brother, very relative to me. Then what association do I have to that person? So we may be associated by an organization, by location, by family. There's some sort of association. And then my final criteria of evaluating the relativity of, and relativity for me is how much time do I want to spend with this person? That's relativity for me, because the meaning of my time is that I'm guaranteed 24 hours a day, and I want to prioritize the people that are most relative, most associated. And then the third one is the most interesting one. I want to surround myself with the most that's going to feed me. And originally I thought, oh, that means if somebody bleeds you, you're not going to spend time with them. But that's not true. In fact, it's counterintuitive, because the things that bleed us sometimes feed us the most. So when my mom got sick, it bled me. A lot, physically, still emotionally, mentally, it was bleeding me. But that bleeding, just like when I bled her as a teenager especially, was probably one of the greatest feedings that I could have. So I prioritize my relationship with my mom because of my relativity, my association, and the amount of feeding that I got throughout my life, either feeding because she was actually feeding me, or the feeding when she was actually bleeding me. And so when you look at the partnership and we align our values, you want to make sure that this person is relative, associated, and is feeding you so that you're complementary in your capabilities. I always say in partnerships, my dad, most of the time, the good advice I got from my dad is don't do what he did. But every once in a while, he had a golden nugget. This is one of my favorites. When it pertaining partnerships, like, Dad, how should I know if I should partner with this guy? He said, here's my rule about partnerships. Never get into a partnership, number one. Two, if you're going to get into a partnership, make sure your partner has more money than you. Three, if you don't listen to rule one or two, just go back to number one. Then he also told me the other great piece of advice is, he's like, if you don't like someone, just wish great success to them. Say, I hope you have thousands of employees and thousands of buildings around the world. He said, you just cursed him. Employees and overhead. He thinks you're complimentary. We're wishing for the best. And you've just given the greatest curse in business. Thousands of employees and buildings. All right. Good question. Relativity, association, and feeding. Steps.
I'll piggyback on that. I think that we all have our Achilles heels and we all have stuff. And actually, I'm curious about this. I haven't talked to you about this before. So, you know, I've been involved in a lot of different, you know, businesses as a surgeon and running a, you know, building a company and building companies. My Achilles heel, I want to know how you deal with it. When we have people, whether it be partners, whether it be, you know, in my world, physicians or managers or employees that are struggling, but yet I know their stories, where they're from, why they're struggling. I've gotten to know them, and now, like, I'm really friendly with them, and I just want to help people in general. So my Achilles heel, everybody knows this, is that me cutting people off is it's the hardest. It's literally the hardest thing that I can do. And I can tell you, I have dragged people that should have been cut off years before that, through stuff, through poor performance, or performative issues, and surgeons that just weren't cutting it, that it was clear they were. How do you deal with that? Having such a big open heart, you know, like you did. It's literally the hardest thing
in the world
that I deal with. Luckily, I have a wife that's, you know, screaming at
me too.
They're horrible. What are you doing? Are you crazy? I'm like, but their family.
Yeah, yeah. So first I'm asking everybody a question and then I'll answer the question. Has anybody fired anyone and said to themselves, man, I should have waited to fire them? Every single time I have to get rid of someone, it was like, shit, why did I wait so long? So first of all, you're human then, because none of us have any differing experiences in getting rid of someone. There's varying degrees of compassion. I have created mechanisms to get rid of my emotional hurt of guilt that I can afford to help this person, and why aren't I helping them? I can afford to help whoever I want. It's kind of like visiting. Bob Proctor told me greatest advice with time. After 5 minutes on the phone, Dave, you're just visiting. After 20 minutes, most of the time in a meeting, you're just visiting. There are exceptions. So if you're going to go over those times, make sure you're visiting with the people you care the most about, not people you don't know or don't want to know. So for me, I'm very pragmatic in the respect that, yes, I can help you, but I start saying, but just like visiting, is there someone I should be prioritizing with the help? Because every $10,000 a month I pay, I could be putting into my kids' education. I could be building another village in Africa, which is important to me. I could be helping Junior Achievement or Napoleon Hill Foundation, things that are really important to me. Not helping someone that could help themselves, one, and two, are actually lying, cheating, and stealing from me. When they're not performing, most of the time it's because they're lying, cheating, and manipulating you. And so they're actually pulling at tags, knowing emotionally, you know, that they didn't make their car payment. And they're not accountable. And you actually are hurting them because you're enabling them instead of telling them the truth. So the corporate mechanism that I've learned to use when I do an evaluation and prioritization that this person, I can help them, but I'd rather help somebody else or something else, is give them the opportunity to perform. So I do a 90-day performance improvement plan. I take complete accountability. I haven't done my job to allow you to perform at a level in which is profitable for the company. Here's the things that I would like to work on with you in order to help you achieve what we need to achieve to keep your position. And they sign a letter saying in 90 days, we're going to reevaluate it. The majority of the time, the person that is entitled, knows what they're doing, is like, the gig is up. They're already interviewed for other, and they're out of there in 30 days. And then it's all off of you. And every once in a while, I don't know what percentage is, it's a fire under their belly and they put a chip on their shoulder and they're like, I'm going to prove David wrong. I really love this job. I may not have been engaged like I should be in prioritizing my job because David was so nice and kind, but I'm going to light a fire and I'm going to prove to him I'm good enough. That's the one I love the most. But 90 some percent of the time, it's like, hey, I got another job. Thank God.
Do you mind if I make a comment?
Please.
I was one of those people. When it's a corrective action with a performance review, and I'd be the number one person in the team because the company supported me because they want me to succeed. And sometimes you feel like, well, I don't know if they're trying to help me, but if somebody really is, you're right. You're stealing if you're not performing. So it actually ended up being the most positive thing.
Yeah, you have to be careful. That is great. 80% rule in people is interesting. Always evaluate. I coach, you know, Chairman of Golf Oil, other places, and I look at 80% of your customers will bankrupt you. What do I mean by that? Most people don't have a keen enough grip on their business. So what happens is 80% of their customers are either breaking even or losing them money. And so if all you were doing business with is people that you're breaking even or losing money with, you would be out of business. You get the math, right? And so we have to take accountability. And the best thing you can do is get rid of a client, especially if they're going to go to a competitor that you're losing money with. You get a double benefit. You're making more money by getting rid of that person, and you just cursed your competitor. I'm serious. But the same holds true with your employees. 80% of the normal big company employees, it's easy when you have a 30 person or under company to not have these percentages because you can have direct contact. But in the big companies, I would venture to say, especially with quieting, quitting and the COVID and all the remote stuff, 80% of the employees in most big companies today are either breaking them even or losing their money. That will bankrupt you. So they're relying on the 20%, not only to make up for the break even and the losers, but also for the profitability that exists today or technology outsourcing or some other capability that had nothing to do with the bleeders that you have. And so if you're taking inventory in your life on who's breaking even and who's losing, give the losers to your competitor, make your break even people profitable. Like you were probably a break even guy, you know, right there on the edge, man, made them profitable, number one guy, you will accelerate your business and your profitability and your success. Great points. All right, next question. Thank you.
I met you last year, read your book.
Thank you.
Putting things into action. I love all the comments business-wise. I have a more family question. So I have four kids, running a company. I've listened to you on balance and how not everything needs to be balanced, unfortunately, but, I also have three daughters too, and, connecting with them, as they grow older, just wanted to hear any advice on that. Any books you might have?
So there's plenty of books. I personally keep things simple when it comes. I give a minimum amount of time to my kids every day. I make sure every single day that they know I love them, I'm proud of them, and I have their back. I ask them when I have those conversations for a minimum of 2 minutes a day, did you do whatever they're doing? I have no judgment because especially with technology, I have no clue. My middle daughter just got promoted to the global social media person for F1. And I have no idea what that really does. But all I ask is, are you doing your best? Tell me what you learned. And are you having fun? That's it. And so my relationship is consistent. I'm on top of what they're doing. I also am not judgmental in what they're doing. I'm just empowering the fact that I don't give a shit what you do, but you better do your best. I want you to live life by learning, and I want you to enjoy it. I want you to learn to enjoy what you don't like or love about what you love. There is no job that everybody loves. I've worked with the people that have the funnest jobs in the world. I have one of the funnest jobs in the world. Professional athletes, professional entertainers, you would think their life is so, they do not love everything about it. Like Marcellus Wiley, one of my good friends and coaching client, right? He's like, you know, I play football for free. I was like, yeah, but you get paid for all the bullshit that you have to do, the weight room, the training, the people running up to you, ruining your dinner with your wife, all the stuff you have to put up to that you don't like or love, but you've learned to love about what you love, which is playing football. And so even with my kids, right, I've learned to love what I don't like or love about them, but I just make sure that they know that I love them, I'm proud of them, and I always have their back. It might sound silly, but I know from being a dad, each of my daughters and even my son, there's been times where I know that they were insecure, afraid, whatever, and it helped them to know that my dad has my back. Like, this is fucked up right now, but I know that my dad has my back, and no matter how screwed up this is, what I did, the biggest mistakes, my dad's made bigger mistakes. He's told me he's made bigger mistakes, and he has my back. So I'm going to go to him and say, hey, I screwed this up. Can you help me? And my relationship's better than ever. And with your parents, the other side is I'm happy, I'm healthy, I love you and appreciate you. And my kids are finally getting old enough where a couple of them actually tell me that, which is cool. Take off your hat for a second. Oh yeah, you have three daughters. Okay. Yeah, I'm kidding. Dan the man, welcome to our neighborhood.
And, I'm looking for the most direct way to salvage the reclaimed lumber that comes down the country. 85% of the reclaimed lumber, extinct species like the chestnut, the antique yellow pine, all these species that are still in buildings up north, we're working on raising awareness for the demolition industry and for the United States, then this valuable lumber that will never grow again is going into the garbage. And it's packing up, landfills, it's creating, a lot of costs for cities. What is the most direct move to raise awareness that starts out here?
Yeah, so there's four ways to build a community around any subject matter, topic, or expertise. Luckily for you, it's a credible issue that has emotional connection. And so if it was me, I'd put together a strategic plan and I'll help you in person. So just things like this, being able to say, hey, you know, this guy just redid the whole house, mahogany, like wood, everything. And I saw your stuff. I'm like, damn, I wish Rory would have known you a year ago. So one, in person, just letting people know this is an issue. Oh, do you know anyone that can help me? Actually, I know a big builder here. I know this guy, et cetera. Two, via email. So Adam, whether he's or not, right? Yeah. So Adam can take an awareness campaign via email. We can get opt-in emails for people that are in building, waste, management, transportation, whatever it is. And then phone, text. So you can create a campaign for text messaging or phone calls and have outsourced phone calls with AI just as an informative one, or there's some conversion of some sort. Are you interested in, you know, bringing value to this by doing this, whatever it is. So we can come up with a strategic in person, on the phone, via email. And then of course, you know, I think it's perfect for a YouTube channel or show where you're going in kind of one of these rehabs and kind of like when Pawn Stars or the Storage Wars show came out, there was great value in junk. You have the exact same thing that people aren't aware of. So everybody's interested in worlds that they don't know about. That's why I like the Sheik of this and the Housewives and the, you know, the Duck Dynasty guys were the perfect example because those guys went to Yale. They were not the guys down at LSU, you know, or Ole Miss. These guys all went to Yale and all they did was give you insight on what it's like to live in the bayou. Right? They're smart as shit. You can do the same thing because there's a huge genre of people that would love to see how do you take a whole bunch of old wood and turn it into his house, right? That's a killer idea.
You have a show. It's Saving Wood by Dan Wolf on YouTube.
I like it. I thought it was something else about wood, but that's the Wave Watch sponsorship that I have. What's that called? Raising Wood or something? He has his Wave Watch to show you. Dr. Pascal, check it out. So anybody interested in the Wave Watch, Dr. Pascal's wearing it for my conversation. Thank you, Dan. All right, next question.
Last question.
Oh, it is last?
Yep.
Okay.
Last one you have.
Mike Carnevale, one of my first coaching clients of all time.
This man is
decade ago.
This man is the GOAT. He's the greatest. Life-changing stuff. My question, well, I have two questions I ask myself every day. What do I believe to be true that isn't? So that is a never-ending question I have. The second question is, what is the next skill that I need to learn? And smart. I believe right now with where I am in my sales training business, the next skill that I need to learn is digital ads. There's a lot of people out there that will run them for you. I believe I need to obtain the skill. Do you know anyone that can help me?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So determine upon what platform you want to run digital ads on, or if you're looking for a strategist or a buyer, depends on what capacity. We have a huge network of people that have been vetted. And when I say they've been vetted, it's because I've spent millions of dollars on people that were full of shit. So I had to find people that actually work. I have, you know, my chief strategist for all digital, who you met years ago, now has his own business, which I partnered in, works with Stefano, loves Justin. If you want a strategist, or if you just want to know from him who's the best person to buy ads on LinkedIn, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, whatever, or what types of ads can we do? These, I know all those people. So just give me a ring and we'll figure out who the best person to start with. You got it. Thank you.